From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. The greatest classical music is timeless, but tastes ebb and flow, and so it is with the styles and techniques of classical vocals. It's the evolution of singing today on Insight. Also today, a top taiko group from Japan brings its drums and flutes to Sacramento this weekend. We'll preview it with an amazing performance recorded in our studio. The group Shidara is based in a mountain village. Their life together is devoted to hard work and musical technique. One of Shidara's apprentices is an American woman. She'll tell you her story. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, one of Japan's top taiko groups, the drummers and flutists of Shidara, live together in a commune dedicated to physical and mental discipline. You'll hear them play in our studio and the story of one of their members, a woman who's lived in Sacramento since the late 90s. First, Western classical vocal music originated centuries ago in the churches and courts of Europe. The music is challenging to sing, especially in large venues, and so styles and techniques suitable for the music were created in parallel. It's easy to imagine the styles and techniques set in stone, but they're not. Even with music as structured and complex and old as classical music, tastes ebb and flow. My guest knows a lot about this. She's Rebecca Plack, a soprano who lives in Davis. She studies how singing styles have changed. Today we'll talk about that, and you'll hear clips from Rebecca Plack's archive of great recordings. We'll also talk about her performing career. She has a concert this weekend in Davis. Rebecca Plack, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
You have a voice studio, and so you teach people how to sing. Let's say this was 1906. What would be different? Would you be showing your students different techniques and styles than you do today?
I hope not. I hope not. I hope that the work that I've done with old recordings has informed the way that I teach and the way that I think about singing. But I hope that I'd be teaching the same fundamentally good principles of singing then that I do now.
The fundamentals, but what about at the margins of the music, the part of the music that's informed by taste? Were people looking for slightly different sounds in the singers 100 years ago today than they are now?
I think so. Again, I'm not sure that would change exactly how I teach. Certainly it changes the kind of repertoire that some of my students want to sing, and the repertoire that they want to sing influences certain things about the way I teach. But no, I'd leave it up to me and I'd bring tastes a little bit back to where they were 100 years ago. So I don't think it would be so different.
Now, you said that, that if anything, you'd like to go back to the tastes of the past. Is that something that you've always had, or was that something that you acquired, that interest in older styles?
It was definitely something I acquired when I was a master's student in voice at the Manhattan School. I was really fortunate to take a seminar with Will Crutchfield, who's a conductor and has written quite a lot on old recording styles. And he played some recordings for us early in the semester, and the moment I heard them, I thought, this is the one thing I want to know how to do. It really was just like being hit by lightning.
You've given us a few clips of music from your archives, and one of them is one of those recordings that you heard very early on, and we're going to listen to it. It's called Canzonette. Could you tell us who's singing?
Sure. A soprano named Alma Gluck. She was born in Romania, moved to America when she was quite young, born in 1882, I think. Not discovered until she was 24 years old, already married. Very unusual career for a light soprano, like as she was. She sang some opera, but primarily concert music and primarily in the United States.
Well, let's listen to part of this Canzonette, recorded in 1916 with Alma Gluck.
Oh,
Rebecca, tell us, what is it you heard in Alma Gluck's singing that affected you so much?
Well, I think it's the way she sings so smoothly from one pitch to the next. There's a kind of lightness and clarity and a certain truth to it. She just glides so sweetly from pitch to pitch. I wasn't used to hearing that in modern recordings that I was accustomed to.
And that gliding is called portamento.
That's right.
Are people taught portamento today?
Depends who you ask. Many of these Italian singing terms are used by different people to mean different things. In the most general sense, portamento means the carriage of the voice. It's the idea that the voice is somehow carried by the breath from pitch to pitch. And a portamento can be audible, as it frequently is in Alma Gluck's singing, or it can be inaudible. So there are people...
What do you mean, inaudible?
Well, that's a great question, and it's very difficult to describe. You can sense it if you sense that the vibration of the voice doesn't change as it passes from pitch to pitch. If the voice goes from pitch to pitch very quickly, the vibration may not change, but there won't be an audible slide between pitches. Whereas if the singer changes from pitch to pitch quite slowly, then you'll hear the progression from pitch to pitch.
Well, it sounds kind of zen.
I guess a little, yeah.
I'm certainly no singer, but I did get some singing classes when I was young, and I was told very strongly, you don't slide up and down in and out of notes. What's the difference between that incorrect sliding that I was doing and the portamento that Alma Gluck was doing?
That's a great question. Many singers and vocal coaches will tell you that there's good portamento and bad portamento. They'll make the distinction between portamento and what you've just called sliding. They'll tell you that good portamento is supported by the breath, properly supported by the breath, whereas bad portamento is not. Bad portamento can sound like swooping or scooping. It's possible that in your early singing classes that you were scooping to a note because you didn't have the technique to attack it cleanly, which you can do either with or without audible portamento.
When did the fashion turn against portamento?
Probably around the Second World War. It's not totally clear whether it was before the war or after the war. Some people, actually a colleague of mine in London, has speculated that there was a move against sentimentality after the Second World War, and that portamento sounds very sentimental. So at that time, people stopped doing it. Other people have speculated that with Toscanini, the famous conductor, and others who wanted singers to adhere more truly to the score, people like that wanted singers to stop sliding quite so much.
Well, today, to my ears, Alma Gluck, it sounds like a charming archive recording, something definitely from the past. What about people closer to the time of Alma Gluck? Let's say people in 1946, just 30 years after she recorded it. How would she have sounded to people then? Would it have sounded just old-fashioned?
That's a really good question. I don't think in 1946 it would have sounded quite so old-fashioned. Singers like Lotte Lehmann and Elisabeth Schumann, who both sang with quite a lot of audible portamento, were still alive and still recording at that time and still concertizing. So I don't know if then it would have sounded quite so old-fashioned.
My guest is Rebecca Plack. She's a soprano who studies the way singing styles have changed over the last century or so, and she has a concert in Davison Sunday afternoon. You brought some more recordings for us, and these demonstrate something else that's changed in the styles of singing. Just tell us quickly what it is we're going to talk about here, and then we'll listen to some music.
Sure, Jeffrey. We're going to talk about something called tempo rubato, which means literally stolen time. It refers to the way a singer plays with tempo in a piece or plays with musical gesture. And we're going to hear first a recording by Leo Slezak, a Moravian tenor who was born in 1873. And we'll hear that he doesn't adhere at all to a strict tempo. He changes the tempo constantly. as compared with a lieder singer, a German singer whom those listeners who are very familiar with the repertoire will know for sure. That's Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, who was born in 1925. And his recording, in contrast with Slezak's, is almost entirely measured in strict time.
Okay. Well, let's listen first to Slezak. This was recorded in 1928. Rebecca, you were smiling during that.
There's one moment, I can't remember if I said, this is a Schubert song from Die Schöne Müller, and it's called Ungeduld, which means impatience. And there's a great moment near the end of the Slezak recording where he's sustaining this high note on the word dein, and the pianist just keeps playing chords underneath him. They're not written in Schubert's score. And the first time Schubert purists hear this recording, they sometimes really flip out because they think the performers are really changing the piece. And in fact, well, it depends on what you think the piece is in the first place. This was a very common performance technique. It was something that, if not explicitly sanctioned by composers, certainly was done by composers within their own pieces. There are many recordings of the composer Richard Strauss accompanying singers in his own music, where they do exactly the same thing that Slezak did, and Strauss is just sitting there playing extra chords until the singer decides he's ready to stop singing the high note.
Wow. Is there any way to know what Schubert would have made of what Slezak and the pianist were doing to his piece?
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
But we do know that Schubert's preferred singer was trained first and foremost as an actor rather than as a singer. And one imagines that his primary objective was to declaim the text in a way that made emotional and dramatic sense to him. So it seems quite possible to me that Schubert might have gone along with him.
Well, keeping in mind the what we just heard by Leo Slezak, here's Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau singing the same fourth and final verse of Ungeduld by Schubert, and this was recorded in 1972.
Ich mein, das müsste in meinen Augen stehen, auf meinen Wangen müsst noch brennen sehen, zu lesen wär's aus meinem stummen Mund, ein jeder Atemzug des Land ihr kommt, und sie merkt nichts von all dem Bangen treibe. Dein ist mein Herz, dein ist mein Herz, o soll es ewig, ewig bleiben.
Hardly even sounds like the same piece. It's so different.
That's right.
And they're just separated by, what, about 44 years?
That's right.
Is the style that Fischer-Dieskau was singing, is that still the what you would expect a mainstream baritone to, how you would expect a mainstream baritone to approach that piece today?
Absolutely.
Do you think it'll ever go back to the Slezak style?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think that performers are often looking for something new to do, and sometimes performers look to something old in order to do something new, just like with fashion. So it seems possible, but very hard to say.
What do you think Fischer-Dieskau would think of Slezak's style?
Oh, I don't want to speculate. he's still alive and well, and who knows, he could be listening.
That's right, on the internet.
That's right.
We have time for one more piece. Let's listen to Meine Rose by Robert Schumann. And let's listen to the older one that you brought along. This is Ria Ginster, a soprano. And what's interesting about this?
partly what's interesting about it is that Ria Ginster has become my new favorite singer, so I just couldn't resist bringing her recording. But what's really interesting about it to me is Ginster sings with a kind of clarity, a kind of vocal core that I think is often lacking from modern singers and modern recordings. I think that in the classical world as well as in the pop world, that singers, there's a fashion nowadays to sing with a more airy kind of tone, and that airiness then gets balanced out by reverb that can be added in a studio after the fact. So what interests me about Ginster is there's very little recording magic that's applied to it. It's really her and the microphone, and we hear this very clarion sound.
Which comes first, style or technique?
It's a fabulous question. I'd have to say I think the two are interrelated in such a complex way that it's really impossible to say which comes first. It would be sort of like asking someone, well, do you dress that way because you're 5'11" and weigh 115 pounds? Or, well, I guess that's sort of obvious. You wouldn't be 5'11" and weigh 115 pounds because you dress a certain way. But I think the two things, it's kind of a nature-nurture question, and it's really difficult to know which comes first.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, more with soprano Rebecca Plack. She'll sing in our studio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight interns get real responsibility and training. The only coffee and the only photocopies you'll make are your own. Find out more at capradio.org/insight. My guest is soprano Rebecca Plack. She lives in Davis and studies how singing styles have changed over the years. That was our topic before the break. Now we'll talk a bit about her singing. She has a concert this Sunday afternoon at 3 in Davis. Rebecca, you have a series of concerts, and they're called Music Matters. Why Music Matters?
It's a way of describing many different ways in which music matters, and also many different matters that we want to explore about music.
And what would those be? Do they relate to what we've been talking about?
The first one does, for the concert this Sunday. It's called Classical Improv, and it explores the ways that the performers transcend the score, different ways in which the score is not itself truth.
To what extent do classical musicians, including singers, improvise today?
Depends on how they're trained, depends on what kind of music they're performing. Certainly in Baroque opera, singers are expected to improvise their own ornaments, improvise their own cadenzas. In other forms of classical music, I think it depends a lot on who you're working with and what kinds of freedoms they'll allow you.
but so much classical music seems so formalized and structured. It seems like there's no room for improvisation much of the time, and that it's not even encouraged. Is that fair?
It might be. I guess, again, there are certainly some teachers, conductors, who approach it that way. I'd like to think not all of us do.
I have a hunch that you're comfortable with improvising.
Oh, pretty comfortable.
Now, one of the pieces you're going to do on Sunday afternoon is Stripsody. Who's that by?
It's by Kathy Berberian.
And tell us what we need to know about Kathy Berberian.
Kathy Berberian was a singer of 20th century music. She specialized in 20th century music, also did a lot of Baroque music. She wrote this piece, Stripsody. I wish that we could show it to everybody who's listening, because it's a series of cartoon images.
I'm looking at it, and it looks like no other musical score I've ever seen.
Yeah, I love showing this to my students when they think that classical music is something really stuffy, because it's published by one of the most famous and oldest classical publishers, Peters. So the cover looks really formal, and then you open it up, and it looks like a series of cartoons for 15 pages.
You're going to sing a couple of them for us, a couple of the pieces from Stripsody. What's the first one?
Well, the first segment is, it's a two-page segment. It involves, the images depict a woman who's sitting at home listening to the clock. She's not happy. She turns on the radio, tunes it to a few different channels, turns it off, and then there's a knock at her door and she's suddenly much happier.
Okay.
Tick-tock, tick-tock, a sigh, dong, dong, dong. Sempre libera di geofolle. She's got a ticket to ride. The weather tomorrow will be mostly cloudy and sob. Knock, knock. Huh? Oh. Oh, smack.
That's funny. Is that difficult to do?
Yeah, it is pretty difficult to do. it's difficult to learn.
You have another segment? Is that the correct word to use?
I guess so. It's all one piece. Some of the segments are basically a glossary of onomatopoeia, of the kinds of things that a radio sound man would do, and they're in mostly alphabetical order. And then some of the things, like the one I just did, depict discrete scenes.
Okay.
So here's a glossary segment. Da-lang, 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 da-ling, ling, 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 tickle, brrrr, urk, fio-yo, sss, grrr, grunt, crump. Nya, nya, nya. Knock, knock, puff, ouch, whee!
That's wonderful. I love it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Need to be a radio soundman on the radio.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, you have a couple of other pieces or excerpts that you can do for us, including a couple of phrases from a Handel aria. Tell us what the aria is and what you're going to do for us.
Well, the aria is called Lascia ch'io pianga. And it's an aria about weeping. It's let me mourn my cruel fate. It's a very sad aria, very beautiful aria. I'm using it on this concert because it's a wonderful vehicle for improvising. The melody is quite simple and easy to remember. So I'm hoping that the audience will be able to hear when I start changing things around. Also, the words are. It's easy to get a sense of how the ornaments go with the words, which maybe I'll talk about after I sing one segment of it. Lascia ch'io pianga mia cruda sorte.
Very nice.
So that's Handel's original, if you will. But Handel, in the first half of the 18th century, would have expected singers to change things around a bit. So, and the way they change things around has to do with both the affect or the emotional character of the piece and also with the individual words. So, for example, when I get to the word kruda, which means cruel, I'm going to lean on it a little bit. I can lean on it in different ways. When I get to the word liberty, which obviously, well, libertà, liberty, I'm going to play with it quite a lot because, well, I can be very free with it because it means liberty.
Lascia che io pianga mia cruda sorte.
Beautiful. It sounded sounded more soulful the second time.
Well, I was trying to dig into the soulfulness of the aria a little bit. Thank you.
You said that that in Handel's time they expected the singers to do that. Did composers like Handel give any guidelines about what they would like you to do, or was it really up to the performer?
I'm really not sure. I do know that Handel worked quite closely with singers who performed his operas, so coaching them and. So one imagines that he had quite a lot to say in rehearsal. Also, there are examples of Handel's own ornaments that have survived that we can look at, but not nearly as many as there are operas and arias.
We just have a minute left, Rebecca. I'd just like to note that at the end of the concert, you and the pianist are going to be taking requests.
We are. We definitely are. We're taking Schubert requests. So we bring seven volumes of Schubert. It's about 350 songs. We pile them on the end of the piano and we take requests.
It sounds very Davis.
Does it?
Oh, it's great. And your concert is in Davis. Where about is it?
It's at the Unitarian Church of Davis. There are some details on my website, which is rebeccaplack.com.
And that's Sunday afternoon at 3.
That's right.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for coming into our studio today and sharing the recordings and singing for us. It was a real pleasure meeting you.
Oh, it was a pleasure for me too, Jeffrey. Thanks a lot.
And listeners, we've uploaded the clips that we played earlier in the show, along with another version of Mina Rosa, a more recent one, on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, one of Japan's top taiko groups. The members of Shidara live together in a commune dedicated to physical and mental discipline. You'll hear them play in our studio and the story of one of their members, a woman who's lived in Sacramento since the late 90s. Here's a clip of their music. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Monday on Insight, you'll hear from two local firefighters who worked at Ground Zero after the September 11th, 2001 attacks. Also next week, the famous Sacramento restaurateur Biba Caggiano tells you about her latest cookbook, and you'll hear from local opera singer Malcolm McKenzie. He's in Sacramento Opera's upcoming production of Mozart's Così fan tutte. A top taiko group from Japan brings its drums and flutes to Sacramento this weekend. The group, Shidara, is based in a tiny mountain village. That location allows the group to focus intently on the physical, mental, and musical growth of its members. One of those members is an American woman called Megan Chow Smith. She's a Sacramento resident and one of the leaders of the local Japanese drumming group, Sacramento Taiko Dan. But in 2005, she became a Shidara apprentice and plans to move full-time to Japan. Some members of Shidara, including Megan, stopped by Insight last week in a rare break in their West Coast tour. Coming up, some drum and flute music recorded in our studio. I started by asking Megan Chow Smith if being a member of Shidara is a lifestyle.
Well, there absolutely is a lifestyle. We purposely live deep in the mountains of Japan. The closest movie theater is a two-hour drive away. We get up every day at 5:30 and run in the mountains for about 6 miles, and from then on, it's 11 hours a day training every single day. Every month, we have maybe 2 days off, and living together and doing everything, cooking, we do all of our costumes. It makes us able to have a harmony and an energy and what they say is that we live with the same heart, so that on stage we're able to share that with our audiences.
Where about in Japan?
Right now we are living in Aichi Prefecture, which is right on the edge of the Japanese Alps.
So how high up?
It's pretty high. Really, it's another world, in fact. The people in the town are mostly the elders. A lot of the young people in the Japanese cities now are leaving to find better vocation. So the way of life is much as how it was lived long, long, long ago.
Now, you say we, and you talk about living there, but your phone number has a 916 area code.
Yes,
do you
does.
Live in both places?
For the last 2 years, I have lived off and on with them, hoping to become a performing member. But I definitely started Taiko in North America, in Boston. And then I had the opportunity to move out to Sacramento, California, and train.
And you're also a member of Sacramento Taiko Dan.
Yes, I am.
Which does similar musical work, is that fair to say?
It is very fair to say. Our teacher, Tiffany Tomaribuchi, her whole mission is to promote the art form in this country. She's been doing this for about 20 years, and to absolutely bring as much of the real Japanese feel of the art to North America.
Listeners, we have photographs of the members of Shidara on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. But Megan, just tell us who's with you and what are they playing for people who can't see the photographs?
Yes, today we have the artistic director. Her name is Chabo. We also have three other members, including myself, four. In the show, there will be 12 of us. But they're ranging age 20 to 40 and...
And
some of the best of us, actually.
And they have fairly large drums. These drums are called taiko,
is
that right? Okay.
Yes, what we have today are called katsugi okedo, and they're made of cedar, and they have nice purple ropes on them. They're slung across our shoulders.
Great. Well, you've got a couple of songs to play for us. The first one is a lively one. What is it? What's it called?
It's called Futen, and actually, Chabo-san wrote this. Last year, we went to the North American Taiko Conference. It's about having fun, and we hope you enjoy it.
Okay. Thank you. Wow, that is amazing. Shidara, in the Insight studio, Megan, you said that one of the members wrote that. What does that mean to write a piece that's so driven by drums? Is there some notation of this, or is it passed on just by demonstrating?
Well, traditionally, it's been passed down voice to voice, person to person. In our group, we also definitely we have sheet music, and the apprentices, we get handed 33-page scores, and we're supposed to learn it by the next day. It's pretty crazy, but there are definitely lots of levels to the different rhythms, as well as adding in the melodies to make something that's very many-faceted, many-layered.
Now, during the piece, there were a couple of points where people came forward, including the drummers. Were they improvising, or is that part of the score as well?
They were improvising. There's definitely a basic skeleton to the pieces, and then if we're lucky, Chabo-san will give us a spot to just go to town and do what we want to do. Actually, the group really specializes in is always looking at each member's character and what they call their color. And so in her song, she's thinking of each member's color and how to best bring that out in our performance.
It looks physically demanding. Is that one of the reasons for the lifestyle that comes with being a musician in Shidara?
Yes, it's extremely physically demanding. And really what sets this group apart is that each member is pushed way beyond their physical, mental, and emotional limits every day as a way of life, so that on stage we are able to go way beyond where people usually think we're able as human beings, and the effect is just an incredible performance.
I read that you once studied at the New England Conservatory of Music and thought of yourself as a classical pianist. Tell us the path from there to being in Shidara.
Well, it's true. I had a very classical background. My mother, my first memory is sitting on the piano bench with my mother and just watching her hands and just knowing I had to do that. I quit because I had the idea that being a musician was impossible in my teens. I did go to the conservatory and through till I was 19. But
what do you mean impossible?
That there was no money in it, that, you know, as a classical pianist, there are like 1,700,000 of us in the world. So I kind of gave up and started working all kinds of different jobs. But I finally, a friend of mine introduced me to the art form, and I just couldn't deny that I was born to be a musician.
Mm. How did you make it to Japan and to join Shidara?
I have the great blessing to know and meet all kinds of taiko leaders in North America. First of all, being Tiffany Tamaribuchi, someone who has gone to Japan and trained as well, toured with other groups, and I was able to kind of tag along as much as possible. But one day I realized it wasn't enough for me and that I wanted to take those kinds of risks with my art and my life. And I was lucky enough after several years to meet Shidara at a contest and went up and begged them on their mountain to let me train with them, which turned into sort of a love affair between us, and that's how it happened.
That was quite a decision to make, to go up the mountain and ask to be an apprentice.
Yes. In Japan, you know, some people would say differently, but it seems if you go stand by someone's doorway, by a great sensei's doorway, every day, and they say, no, 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 but you go every day and say, please teach me, there's a lot of respect gained in that sort of approach.
So were they surprised when you showed up in the door?
I'm sure they were. In typical, wonderful Japanese fashion, of course they didn't show it, but it's pretty rare for a foreigner to ask to live in the mountains with no heat, no air conditioning, to have such a grueling schedule, and to want to dive into the art form, a Japanese art form like this.
And how do you support yourself when you're doing that? Or are you employed by Shidara, or is there some other arrangement?
In fact, the apprentices do pay a small fee every month. The apprenticeship is about a year long. One girl, one of the women in front of me, she was 19, she spent 6 months sewing kimono so that she could pay to train with Shidara. It's really incredible.
Where do you see yourself in the future? Are you going to be full-time Shidara? Are you going to be here, Sacramento, or somewhere else?
what makes me happiest is every day, every moment, being able to train and learn how to be an artist with my body. And where we're living in the mountains, that's everything for me. I can't take myself away from it. In the meantime, we've also been producing this U.S. tour, and there's plenty to do. I want to live in the forest with them as long as possible.
Interesting you say express yourself, I think, as an artist with your body. People would think you're a dancer, but you're a drummer.
Absolutely. It's not just drumming, it's stage acting, it's dancing, it's a sport, a team sport. It's so many things, it's theater all at once.
You do all that?
We do, we try. The training is extremely, we are, all take dance together, and we study other aspects of Japanese culture, but we're also encouraged to watch great epic movies and read great books, every way we can to become the greatest human beings we can.
Is it almost like being a monk?
My friends tell me it sounds like that. It is very austere, it is very intense, but it's just, that's what makes them great on stage.
Well, you all look very happy for such an austere sounding existence.
Yes, living in the country, they always surprise me with their humor and their ability to just move through obstacles at any time.
Well, Megan, you have Shidara has another song for us, a slow one. What's
yes.
This one called?
It's called Kazuyui, and actually all of our songs are based on the beautiful forest, the rivers that you hear all the time throughout the year, the wildlife. You know, we see wild boars walking across our windows. I wake up to a monkey every day on my window. And our intention is bringing the feel of the Japanese mountains to our stage. So yes, this next song is about the countryside where we come from.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
After your concert tomorrow night in Sacramento, where is Shidara going?
In fact, this is our last concert of the tour. So yeah. soon after we'll be headed out back to Japan.
Could you thank the other members for me?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I will.
Megan Chow-Smith, it was a pleasure meeting you.
Thanks,
and everyone
Sophie.
Else.
Thank you very much.
That's Megan Chow-Smith of the Japanese taiko group Shidara. They play Sacramento this weekend, Sunday afternoon at 3 at the Crest. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the KXJZ stations, a portrait of French singer-songwriter Charles Aznavour. He's 82 and still working. That story and the day's news next on The World. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our assistant producer is Jen Picard. Insight's senior producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Our executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us. The fifth anniversary of 9/11 is upon us. Next time in Insight, you'll hear from two local firefighters who worked at Ground Zero after the attacks. Also, you'll meet an Air Force veteran who blogged about his experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Monday afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.